Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, after a lull in reporting about the Japanese nuclear disaster, comes news that officials there are admitting that radiation releases were much larger than previously claimed. Not a surprise to critics who saw those early claims as part of a government corporate media misinformation loop that kicks in whenever we talk about nuclear power. So what is the real story out of Fukushima, and where can you get independent information? We'll talk to journalist and activist Harvey Wasserman. Also on the show, 10 years ago, mainstream media were running stories like the Dallas Morning News' Finding Relief, Tax Bill May Perk Up Individual Finances This Year and Beyond, talking about what have come to be known as the Bush tax cuts, about which many promises were made that are extremely relevant for today's conversation about the deficit. Are the lessons learned? We'll hear from Andrew Fieldhouse of the Economic Policy Institute. All of that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
No political party has a corner on scandal, but some commentators like to make partisan issues of them. Discussing the Anthony Weiner scandal on his June 6th Fox News show, Sean Hannity agreed with his guest, WorldNet Daily's Joe Farah, that Democrats adhere to different, less honorable standards when it comes to scandals. The difference? Democrats like Bill Clinton and Charles Rangel stay in office after their scandals come to light, where Republicans do the honorable thing and leave. As Hannity put it, quote, "You know, you think back when Republican scandals come up, they all bail out. I can't think of one that ever stayed. Can you?" Close quote. Hannity would have a point, except for Republican Senator David Vitter, who is still in office after his prostitution scandal, and Republican Senator John Ensign, who stayed in office for nearly 2 years after having an extramarital affair and allegedly paying hush money to his lover's spouse, and Republican Senator Larry Craig, who finished out his term after being arrested for lewd conduct in a public bathroom, and Republican South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford, who completed his term after admitting to an extramarital affair, and Rudy Giuliani, who, married, literally paraded his then-girlfriend Judith Nathan around town in 2000, later informing his wife and family that he was seeking a divorce via a televised news conference. And speaking of Giuliani, on Hannity's own show, Giuliani joins Dick Morris with his past prostitution scandal and serial adulterer Newt Gingrich in topping the show's list of favorite guests. Perhaps Hannity prides himself on giving scandalous GOP types a place to go?
Another denunciation of U.S. NATO airstrikes from Afghan President Hamid Karzai followed an incident in which 14 civilians were killed, including 11 children. ABC World News took up the issue and Karzai's call for some restrictions on bombing raids on May 31st. And Pentagon reporter Martha Raddatz had strong feelings, derived, she explained, from personal experience.
They simply have to carry out airstrikes over there. It's a very rapid response. It's real-time intelligence. It's certainly flawed at some point. But I've been on these missions. I've been on a combat mission in a fighter jet. I've seen all the very, very careful steps they take. They go through what's called a nine line. In fact, the mission I went on, some French soldiers were calling for them to bomb, and the pilot and the weapons officer said, "We can't bomb. We think there's a school. We think there might be people in there."
So we shouldn't let civilian deaths make us question the use of airstrikes, because on the combat mission she, the national correspondent, went on, military declined to bomb a school right in front of her. Viewers could be forgiven for finding such evidence less persuasive than she does, though the piece helpfully included footage of Raddatz on her combat mission, gathering all the facts necessary to produce this kind of journalism.
The Washington Post ran a headline on June 3rd that read, "A reprieve for higher ed companies." A more honest headline might have been, "A reprieve for us," meaning the Washington Post. The story discussed congressional action on a bill that would increase oversight of federal student loans to private, for-profit colleges, which often do a poor job of preparing students for the workforce. The Washington Post company, it turns out, has substantial investments in such schools, a fact the story disclosed, though a little late in the game. The 14th out of 22 paragraphs read, quote, half a dozen leading firms in for-profit education, including the Washington Post Company, on behalf of its Kaplan Education Division, and the trade group Coalition for Educational Success, spent a total of $4.3 million lobbying in 2010 and at least $2 million this year. Close quote. After mentioning that this intense lobbying campaign succeeded in watering down the bill, the story quotes one of the lobbyists involved. Quote, "I wouldn't say people are dancing in the streets," said one lobbyist who asked for anonymity to protect relationships with clients and officials, "but it is certainly an improvement over the proposed regulation." Close quote. This lobbyist is either working for the Post or working alongside the Post's lobbyist, but the paper gives them anonymity to protect relationships with clients? You see a lot of absurd justifications in newspapers for the overuse of unnamed sources, but that might just be a new one.
If newspapers were visibly labeled world events as they affect the wealthy few, it'd be one thing. But since they aren't, readers have to sort some things out on their own. For example, take the Wall Street Journal's treatment of two elections with different outcomes, both reported in the June 6th edition. Where the left loses, we get, quote, "Portugal decisively ends leftist rule. Portugal on Sunday voted decisively to end 6 years of leftist rule, electing the country's main conservative party and boosting prospects for austerity measures tied to a $114 billion aid package from the EU and IMF," close quote. Where the left wins, we get, quote, "Peru votes in divisive runoff for president. Voters in one of the world's most dynamic economies went to the polls Sunday to choose between two divisive presidential candidates," close quote. That latter piece on Peru underscored that, quote, "financial markets, which have been riding a roller coaster during the long campaign, would be almost certain to take a win by Mr. Humala badly," analysts say, close quote. This was also the main angle at the Washington Post, where the June 7th report was headlined, quote, "Peru's path is question mark as nationalist wins presidential race. Investors worry whether he will pursue leftist economic policies," unquote. And at the Los Angeles Times, whose story was, quote, "Leftist's victory rattles Peruvian stock market. After his narrow win, Ollanta Humala seeks to reassure the business class, but his previous pledge to work for better distribution of the nation's silver and gold wealth sends the market down by more than 12%, unquote. Hey, viewing elections through the eyes of the investor class, such that a better distribution of wealth is cause for worry, is surely helpful for some. It just doesn't seem like a great way to understand what the people of a country are thinking or why they vote the way they do.
And finally, op-ed pieces are supposed to have a point of view, of course, but there are certain simple rules about disclosure that most papers follow. Like, say, if a writer has a financial interest in what he or she is writing about. Readers need to know that. But USA Today's readers were left in the dark on June 1st when the paper ran a piece by former Secretary of State James Baker about domestic oil drilling. The headline, "Cut the Red Tape, Free Up Oil Drilling in Alaska," sort of tipped his hand. But in arguing his point, Baker dwelled on the efforts of one company in particular, Shell. Readers were told that Shell has invested millions to drill in Alaska, only to be stymied by federal bureaucrats worried about things like air pollution. Why focus on Shell? It might pay to look to Baker's other work for the answer, specifically the James A. Baker Institute's Energy Forum. The center is funded by a variety of energy companies, but the most prominent contributor would seem to be Shell, which foots the bill for the Shell Distinguished Lecture Series, which is apparently the Baker Institute's flagship speakers program. When FAIR notified USA Today about this conflict, they issued a correction on June 8th, which was the right thing to do. A better thing, of course, would have been to ask some fundamental questions about Baker's connections before running the piece.
Thank you, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by FAIR.
On June 6th, the Japanese government admitted that the stricken Fukushima reactors, in the first days of the crisis, may have emitted more than twice as much radiation as previously reported. In May, after denying for weeks that any of the nuclear plants had melted down, Japanese regulators and officials finally fessed up that three reactors had probably melted down. To nuclear power critics who said that Fukushima was far more serious than was being admitted, corporate and official misinformation about accidents and radiation releases is not exactly new. But it's hard to know who you can trust and what new falsehoods might be floated as the ongoing disaster in Japan moves forward. With us to talk about all this is Harvey Wasserman, a well-known activist, author, and the editor of the website nukefree.org. Harvey Wasserman, welcome back to Counterspin.
Well, it's an honor. Thank you very much.
Well, that Japanese officials and TEPCO officials have been misinforming the public is not very different from earlier nuclear disasters at, say, Three Mile Island or Chernobyl. But the June 6th story about emissions being much greater than admitted earlier managed to get some pickup. The New York Times, for instance, reported it, though the Washington Post passed on the story. But we saw that story as breaking something of a lull, something of a silence in reporting from Fukushima. Did you notice that same lull in reporting?
Well, actually, if you looked at the mainstream media, the corporate media, you would have thought that the Fukushima accident ended flat out, was over the minute we invaded Libya. There was pretty substantial coverage in the American corporate media of Fukushima, especially at CNN and the New York Times, both of whom covered it pretty well. Except on the health side, health issues, they weren't good. But the engineering stuff, they did get to. But then all of a sudden, everything disappeared. Having been with this story for more than 40 years, I can tell you that it's common. It's expected, actually, that governments and the industry will lie about what's happening at a nuclear plant. What's scary about Fukushima is that not only do we know they're lying, but I really don't know what's going on. And, they may be lying to cover up what they think they know. But we have no faith that they actually have a handle on the realities of the situation there. And that's what's really terrifying.
What are some important things people should know about what's happening in Japan and how it could affect them here?
Well, the accident is in no way, shape, or form over. In addition to admitting to larger radiation releases, the TEPCO and the Japanese government have admitted that three of the reactors did, in fact, melt down. We now believe that it's gone to the second stage, which is that the fuel has melted through the pressure vessel and into the bottom of the reactor containments, and that they may be able to melt through even that. So we're really in a very terrifying situation here. We have three reactor cores that are out of control. We had a spent fuel pool in Unit 4 that was on fire. We don't know if it's still on fire. There does appear to be some heat involved. Units 5 and 6, which were shut when the tsunami hit, may not be fully under control either. There's no guarantee that even a reactor that's shut is going to be free of this destruction because you have to continue to cool them with water, and we don't know that can continue to happen. And I got to tell you, at nukefree.org, we've posted about 500 articles since 3/11. And even though it's not in the corporate media, the flow of information sub rosa through the Internet and also Japanese sources has been not only substantial but terrifying. We are now reading that radiation levels have risen at Unit 1, risen to the point where we're getting close to the situation where workers may not be able to go in at all. And if radiation releases get that high, then we're in really serious trouble because there's no way to control these plants. Now, this is not a situation where they can't send workers in because maybe later on in life they'll get cancer. This is a situation where they can't go in because they'll drop dead on site. And so, you know, God forbid radiation levels should continue to rise to that point. We could be in worse shape than we were on 3/11 when this thing happened.
Well, one story that did run during this period of relatively little reporting on the nuclear disaster was about Fukushima City proper, a city of 300,000 people about 35 miles from the stricken reactors that's so radioactive that the government initially raised the permissible radiation limit for children there by more than 20 times. In part, it seems, because they say a city of that size could not be evacuated. Add to this that Japan has raised acceptable doses for school children and workers twofold for the country. And it sounds like a nightmare, as you said, terrifying before. It sounds like a nightmare is unfolding there. But back in the States, there's a lull in the news, and the Times story about Fukushima City gets virtually no pickup. What is the media's reticence?
Well, they're corporate control. This is a corporate-induced coma. You know, you have huge investments in nuclear power in this country. We have 104 reactors. If you figure $10 billion at net present value per reactor, just as a rule of thumb, you do the math on 104 reactors. In Japan, the permanent shutdown of the 6 reactors at Fukushima was worth $60 billion just right off the top. Three Mile Island, which turned from a $900 million asset to a $2 billion liability, you know, in 15 minutes. And so this is a very serious corporate investment in nuclear power. We do have $36 billion in the federal budget from Obama to build more nuclear plants in this country, which is at stake. And so there's very clearly a corporate agreement that they're not going to control. Now, they're not going to cover this story very often. Only the Times, really, the New York Times, someone at the New York Times understands how bad this is. So they have run a few stories, which I've posted at nukefree.org, even independently, that have been pretty strong. But the LA Times, the Washington Post, the other major media really aren't covering this. You have to get your information off the internet and at nukefree.org, where we're trying to post a sort of real-time archive of what's been going on, which is taking up my time. I mean, it's about 500, as I say, about 500 articles since Fukushima. And I have to tell you that in the Sub Rosa world of the internet and of Japanese and other coverage, there has been no let up in the coverage here. It's only that it has not made it into the major media.
Well, corporate and government officials are misinforming, and the media is largely dutifully reporting the misinformation. Time and again, there are people who are getting things right about safety and about the dangers of ionizing radiation. But the media never seem to learn anything, and so they never turn to those sources that urge more caution. Through the years, that's been people like you. There's Steve Wing, the University of North Carolina epidemiologist. There's Alice Stewart back in the 50s at Cambridge University cautioning against X-raying fetuses. There was John Goffman, Carl Z. Morgan. There are so many of these people with incredible amounts of expertise that are not turned to by the media.
Well, you find that when these experts like John Goffman, who is no more prestigious person than was there in the United States on this issue than John Goffman, he was the head of the health department at the Atomic Energy Commission. But the minute he stepped outside the box and reported deaths at nuclear plants, which the industry didn't want to hear, he suddenly became a non-person. Right. Now, today we have Robert Alvarez at the Institute for Policy Studies, Arne Gunnarsson at Fairwinds, mm-hmm. Gordon Edwards, and a number of other people who are doing superb analysis of what's going on at Fukushima and who are held at the fringes. I mean, both Bob and Arne have been on CNN, and they are quoted in the Times from time to time, but not with their full impact. And I will say that the biggest story that the American media has missed is that the radiation from Fukushima has come here. Mm-hmm. And the Obama administration has been incredibly derelict in their duty to protect the American public. We should have a real-time, internet-available map showing where radiation is now coming down from Fukushima and what can be done to protect ourselves. And there has been absolutely no such service brought forward by the American government. And this is really the worst travesty of all in terms of the people in this country.
Just as a program note, the July edition of Extra Affairs magazine will have a piece written by yours truly about the New York Times and the Washington Post health coverage on radiation releases and addressing many of those same issues.
Yes, well, this health issue is the third rail. They will not touch it. And I remember very clearly, I was pretty much glued to CNN, whose coverage of Fukushima was actually very good and very in-depth until they got to the health issue. And there was this moment where Sanjay Gupta and Anderson Cooper were talking about, you know, the accident, and then suddenly Sanjay Gupta out of nowhere starts talking about how the radiation isn't really dangerous to Americans. It's based on absolutely nothing scientific, complete wing and a prayer, cited no serious sources, completely negated the value of their coverage, as has, by the way, National Public Radio, which has been absolutely horrible on this issue. You had Scott Simon recently say on a Saturday show that no one was hurt at Three Mile Island, not even a sprained ankle, an utterly absurd and irresponsible and inaccurate comment. And NPR has continually downplayed the health issues of radiation, as has all of the major U.S. media. The New York Times, although its coverage of the accident overall has been somewhat reasonable, except for the huge gap between then and now, still won't touch the health issue.
We've been speaking with Harvey Wasserman, activist, journalist, and the editor of nukefree.org. Thanks for joining us today on Counterspin, Harvey Wasserman.
Well, thank you, and come see us at nukefree.org, and we'll keep you posted.
Bush signs tax cut, checks in the mail in July. president hails new tone in Washington. That headline pretty much reflects the tone of reporting 10 years ago with the enacting of the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2001, one of a number of tax changes made at the time. The media emphasis was on the rebate checks Uncle Sam was mailing out. Tax rebates should lead to a little shopping, was another headline, part of the promise to inspire consumer confidence and spur the economy. 10 years later, a clear-eyed assessment of the impact of those tax cuts could only elevate the budget debate. But the conversations mainly left two politicians with talking points, leaving viewers and readers not much better informed. Here to help us sort rhetoric from reality is Andrew Fieldhouse, federal budget policy analyst with the Economic Policy Institute. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Andrew Fieldhouse.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, EPI has a policy memo on the impact of the Bush-era tax cuts, and it highlights 10 elements or 10 facts. But when I looked back at the media coverage from the time, media seemed mainly focused on what I guess they thought was the consumer good news angle, which was these checks. How are Joe and Mary spending their $600? The idea seemed clear that this was aimed at stimulating the economy via consumer spending. So let's start, if you would, with how that aspect of things panned out.
Sure. The Bush tax cuts were never meant as stimulus. They were designed on the campaign trail, but they were marketed as stimulus because they were enacted for the first time 4 months into the 2001 recession.
Mm-hmm.
The impact on paychecks was pretty minimal. The paychecks that were impacted the most were the paychecks at the very top of the income distribution. We like to think in economic terms, that wealthier citizens have less incentive to spend an extra dollar of income. They're more likely to save it. So if the goal is really propping up consumption, the tax cuts should have been targeted further down the income stream instead of going overwhelmingly to those in the top 10% and very disproportionately those in the top 1%. The top 1% of tax earners received 38% of the tax breaks by 2010. 55% of the tax breaks went to the top 10% of earners. If you were trying to stimulate broad consumption, you would have flipped that upside down and overwhelmingly targeted the tax cuts to the lower 60% of the income distribution.
So it's not really something that should have worked but didn't. It's more that it was misrepresented really from the get-go.
Correct.
Well, we're talking about today, of course, and Beltway media right now are consumed with the deficit. It's soaring. It's out of control. It's the reason we almost certainly need to curtail those social services provided to those that need them. What ties is it fair to draw between the story of the day, the federal deficit, and those tax changes that were made 10 years ago?
The Bush tax cuts helped squander the Clinton-era surpluses and created structural budget deficits that we still face today. Most of the deficit for this year is the result of the recession. We're still operating 5% below potential economic output. We're still spending a lot of money on unemployment insurance, on things to help cushion the fall in private sector demand because of the bursting housing bubble. But underneath that is the legacy of the Bush-era tax cuts. We're still losing revenue because of the Bush tax cuts. We're also paying off interest on the last decade of tax cuts. This current year alone, we're spending roughly $50 billion on interest from the previous decade of tax cuts. And these costs continue. All of the Bush-era tax cuts were extended last December, part of a compromise to get another year of unemployment insurance and a little bit more support for the economy. Going forward, the Bush tax cuts continue to threaten the fiscal outlook. If you continued current policy for the alternative minimum tax, extending all the Bush tax cuts would add $3.8 trillion to budget deficits over the next decade, including debt service. $3.8 trillion is not insignificant. If you look at the National Fiscal Commission, their objective was to reduce deficits by about $4 trillion. All of that gets wiped away if you extend all the Bush tax cuts.
Well, as I suggested, in the media, it seems that claims as simple as the fact that those tax cuts grew the deficit and that they benefited the wealthy above all, those claims are often coming from the mouths of politicians. For economists, how debatable is this? Is this really a he said, she said thing?
You hear politicians say that the Bush tax cuts didn't reduce revenue. Last summer we heard Mitch McConnell say that they paid for themselves because of their vibrancy, the suggestion that higher growth offsets the loss in revenue. You can't find a single Bush administration economist who backs that claim. They've all run away from it. In the economics profession, there's really no disputing the fact that the Bush tax cuts blew a huge hole in our budget outlook. They didn't increase growth sufficiently to make it to the middle class. I'm sure they helped a little incrementally, but the benefits never trickled down. I mean, this is the only economic expansion in the post-war era, the Bush economic expansion, where inflation-adjusted wages fell for the median worker.
Let me ask you finally, in your view, what keeps this idea so alive that tax cuts for the wealthy and tax cuts for corporations are going to grow the economy? It's kind of a truism in the media that tax cuts will benefit everyone. If we have a track record that suggests that it doesn't work that way necessarily, why is that idea so vital? Why are we always in a position of saying, well, you know, it actually didn't happen like that?
I think this is more about an ideological attack on government than anything else. Mm-hmm. I think the objective is shrinking both revenue and government expenditure as a share of GDP. If you look at the stuff Grover Norquist says, Grover Norquist is behind the anti-tax, anti-government movement. He comes out and says, well, periodically, this isn't about deficit reduction. This is about shrinking government. That's the real objective. Why cut taxes for the wealthy? And that's where the money is. If you want to shrink government, that's the really, really effective way to do it.
We've been speaking with Andrew Fieldhouse, policy analyst at the Economic Policy Institute. Find their memo on the 10th anniversary of the Bush-era tax cuts on their website. It's epi.org. Thanks very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me on.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.